Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou. Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He's the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, guys.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Paul, I'd like to start with you. There have been a myriad of articles in the New York Times and elsewhere talking about Rikers Island and the fact that Rikers has a coronavirus infection rate 78 times that of the general population. Now, even the prison guards union is involved, saying that they're concerned for their people, not for the prisoners, but for their own people, the guards, because more than two dozen of them have come down with coronavirus. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, I think as we've reported extensively on the show, prisons and jails in this country are poorly prepared to deal with any type of medical issues, much less a pandemic, and especially one that's easily spread through the air like coronavirus is. And I think that's probably not unexpected that Rikers Island would be a public health disaster, as a jail's doctor is candidly admitting, just because the facility has long had lots of problems, both related to brutality, corruption, and, of course, medical care. That's even at the best of time. And to the extent that it's a large jail in this U.S. city that has the highest unknown cases of coronavirus at this point, I'd say it's, you know, definitely not surprising that it has such a high rate of infection. And I think it's worth noting that, you know, this isn't new. And I think, you know, longtime listeners to the program and also longtime readers of Prison Legal News recall that, you know, Rikers Island has been an epicenter for diseases for literally as far back as we've been reporting on it, and probably it long predates that, whether it was Legionnaire's disease, hepatitis C, HIV/AIDS. All of these infectious diseases have found fertile ground in prisons and jails in particular, Rikers Island in general, and Rikers Island in particular. And I think that probably almost the one that's most probably relevant for purposes of the current pandemic was the spread of drug-resistant tuberculosis, which swept through Rikers Island around a decade ago. And again, guards at that time were concerned. And I think this kind of shows, I think, the short-sighted nature of everything to do with our prison and jail system is that there's a crisis, it gets a little bit of attention, then it recedes, and then it goes back to business as usual of literally just plain old neglect and not paying attention. And historically, prisoners' lives are viewed as expendable, and generally the lives of the guards or the staff aren't much more valuable as far as from the perspective of the people running these places, but they do have guards unions, they do have workers' protections, and they do have mechanisms to make their concerns heard that prisoners don't have.
Yeah, Kevin, I went through the same thing when I was in prison. There was a guy in my cell block who came down with tuberculosis, and the only guidance the rest of us got was just don't shake hands with him. That's kind of what they're telling prisoners in Rikers. It's like, well, you know, good luck. Don't make out with the guy if you don't want to get coronavirus. But it's even uglier than that. Kevin, you've highlighted a piece for us from The Intercept saying that Rikers Island prisoners are being offered $6 an hour to dig mass graves. So that's what it's come to. Yeah.
Yeah. And apparently this is Heart Island. It's been a site that has, and I don't have a whole lot of familiarity with it, but it appears that for decades, it seems that you have photos in black and white showing prisoners digging these graves, that they've been put to this kind of work. And it seems like naturally what has happened with a lot of states is being hard up for labor, needing people to do these jobs, knowing that there's not a lot of interest among the public to protect their lives, that they feel politically they can get away with exposing these individuals to the threat of infection. So they've got prisoners digging graves and, prepared to send. I mean, so far, is it close to 1,000 people in New York City that have died, or in the New York State alone that have died from the coronavirus. So, you know, they're preparing for the surge in deaths that continue in New York. And I mean, again, like it's these kinds of examples of having people do these jobs that show you just how little these people are valued, these prisoners, how dehumanized they are in our system.
Paul, that really is what it comes down to, isn't it?
Well, one of the things I'd like to point out, too, is about this, you know, the immediate reliance on prison slave labor to address the crisis is, you know, whether it's the Berry bodies or, you know, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo coming out that prisoners in correctional industries in New York State who are being paid 16 cents an hour are going to be making hand sanitizer for distribution in New York. I think that one of the things as we've seen is millions of Americans are losing their jobs. You know, the thought of paying people a living wage to work, whether in prison or out of prison, is apparently not even on the agenda. The immediate response is, let's enslave people and let's use state slaves for 16 cents an hour to do jobs that maybe the millions of people that have been thrown out of work outside of prison could actually use to support their families. And I think that really illustrates, I think, you know, how prison slavery harms everyone, including people outside of prison. And of course, you know, prisoners and taxpayers alike. And the fact that this is deemed so important and so essential that it's got to be done, but we're only going to pay people 16 cents an hour to produce the things that can be used to save lives. I mean, I think that's quite the telling comment on the values of our political class in this country.
Yeah, I have to agree. Kevin, Andrew Cuomo has become a star, at least on CNN. And, you know, despite his very long record on criminal justice issues, which, frankly, I think he should be ashamed of, people seem to think that he ought to be the Democratic nominee for president because of the way he's handled this coronavirus issue. But tell us a little bit about Andrew Cuomo's treatment of prisoners in the past, especially as it relates to Rikers.
Well, so, I mean, the deal right now that people should be focused on, I think, is the state system and what Andrew Cuomo was failing to do to acknowledge the threat. But I just want to mention very quickly here that they're not really making any hand sanitizer. There's a good article out there if people want to go to Vice and find it. There were inmates that spoke who mentioned that they're actually just taking some mysterious vendor's liquid and bottling it into these containers that say NYS clean on them. So they're just basically just shooting out this liquid into these bottles and then pushing them on. And so they, even the inmates who are being put through the slave labor, they're actually not making hand sanitizer. So that's one thing to consider as he's being deified. I'll also add in that he's still forcing through these Medicaid cuts in the budget in the state, and he's also apparently trying to unravel and unroll undo the bail reform law that was passed after Kalief Browder's death. And so this is a huge deal here, that what you're saying is he's been essentially deified. He's being treated as a kind of godlike figure who strolls out and he does these press briefings, and these are supposed to be how you should handle the press briefings. And people act like they're better than Donald Trump's because they're clear and coherent. And in reality, some of the biggest issues is that he's not using his power to release people from these prisons. He's not adequately recognizing that there are people who are in danger in his facilities, in these state facilities. You've got elderly people in these facilities that could be released, and they're not being released. And at the same time, he's considering unraveling bail reform laws, which would mean that there'd be more detainees that would enter facilities, and then they'd be even more vulnerable to the spread. So he hasn't really talked about prisoners as a community that's at risk through all of this. Now, maybe he's not unique. If you look at all 50 states, I don't particularly see a lot of governors acknowledging this issue, but let's just say that the only time that he's really spoken about prisoners was to celebrate their role being involved in slave labor to pump out hand sanitizer into bottles. So it just shows how little he cares about the risk of infection in these prisons. And that's, I think that's something that's really a demark, in my opinion, on the way he's handling this crisis.
Paul, what do you think? You've watched governors over the last number of decades and their responses to some of these crises in the criminal justice system. What would you say about Andrew Cuomo's response to the coronavirus vis-a-vis those incarcerated New Yorkers?
Well, I think, you know, the one thing I think he gets good marks on is that he's one of the few governors that's actually reduced his prison population significantly over the past decade. And they've actually, it's been a fairly large percentage decrease in the prison population in New York. With regards to the current crisis, though, I think that medical care in New York prisons has never been that great as they are anywhere else. The medical care for prisoners has never been a priority in New York or anywhere else. And I think, you know, Kevin makes a good point, is that the governor could be using his power to release vulnerable prisoners. And I think one of the most obvious places is looking at all the thousands of prisoners who are past their parole dates. They're being held in prison long past their parole dates, of not being found eligible for parole. Many of them are elderly. Many of them have compromised immune systems and are very vulnerable, not just to the coronavirus, but to the, you know, the many illnesses that circulate freely in prison systems. So I think, you know, those are all issues where I think, you know, you kind of see the failure of leadership. And as I'm looking through the international news wires, I'm seeing countries around the world, Iran, Turkey, the Philippines, all these countries are using the coronavirus as, you know, as whether it's an excuse or a reason or whatever you want to call it, but they're seizing the opportunity to dramatically release their prison population, reduce their prison populations by releasing tens of thousands of prisoners. And I think that in some respects, it's almost a candid admission on the part of the people running prison systems in other countries that, look, we don't have the resources or the ability to contain a massive epidemic in our prisons. Those issues are better addressed in the community. Whereas here in the United States, I don't really see that any people running prisons, whether it's New York or anywhere else, is saying that they're well prepared, that they're going to be able to do a good job at it. Instead, I think without saying it, but implicitly by their inaction, what they're saying is the lives of prisoners are expendable and we don't care if a bunch of people die. Maybe that's going to be our reduction of mass incarceration, is if a bunch of people in prison die all of a sudden. And that, I think, is kind of when you compare the response, not just here in the U.S., which I think is a pretty bad one nationally, but when you compare it to the international response to how are other countries dealing with the coronavirus epidemic. And pretty much a lot of other countries are saying, you know, hey, we just need to dramatically reduce our prison population through mass releases. Yet that's not really happening in this country with regards to the convicted prisoner population. And Cuomo is no exception on that.
Yeah. Kevin, the Illinois National Guard has been deployed to Stateville Prison after the death of an inmate, and 48 other inmates have tested positive there. What's the Illinois National Guard supposed to do to make things better?
They're supposed to pick up the slack for the state prison healthcare system that hasn't adequately done its job, and they're supposed to make up for the disinvestment in taking care of prisoners that is systemic to these state facilities. So they show up to Stateville, a facility that before this crisis had multiple examples of cruel and inhuman treatment within their facilities. There were lawsuits for solitary confinement, the way that was employed against prisoners in the past years. And so now they come here because it's out of control, and they need to set up medical tents. They need to do triage. They've got to actually take the inmates that are being tested and that have tested positive. They have to remove them, the facility, in certain ways so that they can be spaced out and actually socially distanced. And you know, I just point out that I don't know if any of these inmates, I don't know each of their individual cases, these 40 plus inmates, but, you know, to the extent that any of them would be near the end of their sentences, maybe would be eligible parole. Some of the issues we were talking about in New York would apply here in Illinois, that those people could just be released and they would not be a burden on the state anymore. And then also they would not be at risk of fueling the further spread of the virus within the state. So facility. But, you know, as we're talking about, I think it's important to emphasize here, as we're talking about, we have not seen our governments in the United States at all levels do what they need to relief individuals. And there's been a lot of work at the grassroots level by bail funds, organizers, by advocates. The ACLU has filed a number of lawsuits. We've seen groups doing critical work to try to force and create pressure for releases. But there's a great resource I should refer people to. If you go to the prisonpolicy.org website, they put together this thing that was put up on April 1st, responses to the COVID-19 pandemic. And you can see a pretty good accounting of what's done. But what stands out is what hasn't been done, because there are multiple counties throughout Colorado, Texas, Washington. There's a few counties in Alabama. There's Hillsborough County in Florida. There's a county in South Carolina. There's a county in Utah. You've seen New Jersey take some steps. There's been a Los Angeles County, and there's been a county in Pennsylvania. But then when you look at states, find that people who have pre-existing medical conditions are not being taken care of so that they aren't vulnerable to the spread. There's really no state action. You've got some action in Illinois. Iowa's taken some steps. North Dakota's parole board has taken some steps. Rhode Island, Colorado, the Utah Department, Georgia Board, and then California has shown some concern. But as I just read that list, I mean, there are 50 states in the United States. I've only named like 10 to 12 states. So the vast majority of this country isn't even doing anything significant to address any of these crises. And so we have, as we've said on the show multiple times, it's become kind of cliche, these petri dishes in these facilities where basically we can expect that the coronavirus is just metastasizing and getting worse by the day.
Absolutely true. And, you know, in prison in a normal time, for most inmates who have somebody on the outside that can put money in their commissary account, they go to commissary once a week and they can buy things like soap or shampoo or what have you. Indigent inmates can't do that. They can't buy things. And so the prison will give them this gross, generic, cheap soap and shampoo. Well, now, Paul, inmates are having to sue their prisons and jails for soap and paper towels because they have no way to protect themselves from the coronavirus. Tell us about that.
Yes, and I think this is one of the things that isn't really new. I think the coronavirus is just kind of accentuating it, is that we've seen that, around the country, you know, we've seen plenty of prisoners have been denied basic sanitation stuff for a long time. I mean, anyone that's been to prisons and jails can note that they generally tend to be pretty dirty places. And even before coronavirus, MRSA, which is a bacterial infection that is spread basically through unsanitary conditions, it ravages American prisons and jails and has for decades, which is kind of the tacit admission that they've never been able to keep prisons or jails with a basic level of sanitation. And now with the coronavirus, this is becoming even more apparent in that we now have prisoners in Washington, D.C., and also in Texas, where they're literally asking federal judges to order the prisons and jails to provide them with, you know, very basic cleaning supplies, which is, you know, hand soap, cleaning supplies to keep their cells and common areas clean. And I think this has just been a long-running issue, and the current coronavirus is just kind of accentuating it. And I think the difference is that before now, MRSA was an issue. Lots of prisoners died from that, as we've reported Prison Legal News, as we've talked about on this show. And now with coronavirus, we're just going to see those numbers go up even more. And I think but at basic government level, though, no one's really asking, why can't our government officials who are spending billions of dollars a year running these prisons and jails, why can't they supply hand soap and basic cleaning supplies? You know, this isn't rocket science.
Yeah, it's not rocket science. It's actually pretty simple. Kevin, one of the things that the Federal Bureau of Prisons is doing is to just simply lock inmates in their cells for 2 weeks. I remember this happening when I was in prison. There was a flu outbreak and we were confined to our cells. But, you know, overcrowding is a major problem. I was in a four-man cell that had six men stuffed into it. You're living literally on top of each other, stacked in bunk beds. So what good is this new federal mandate going to do when you just lock people in their cells for the next 2 weeks and say it's to protect them from the coronavirus?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to have the kind of effectiveness that is being claimed by the Bureau of Prisons. But we know that oftentimes bureaucrats or the FLAC or the spokespeople for these agencies will make claims about how they're dealing about a crisis. And we'll know very soon, fairly quickly, that they were absolutely wrong. But I think it just amounts to hubris. You actually see this out in the state of Massachusetts with a Republican governor who has defied calls to release people and is basically saying that, you know, we've got it all under control. We know what to do with these people. I think that the ideology in the Bureau of Prisons is probably fairly similar. So I'll just read what Charlie Baker said, the governor, which was, "We don't buy as a matter of law, fact, or policy that the argument that's being made before the court is the correct one, which is that you should release people. We believe the correct position is for us to be continuing to do the things we're doing to keep the people inside safe, and that's going to be the way we play this one." So I think you have this hubris of just this unwavering belief that they know what's right and how to keep inmates safe and that they're the best people. I mean, obviously, part of that viewpoint comes from being more on the side of incarceration than on the side of decarceration. I mean, it's easy for people who favor decarceration or even the abolition of prisons to make these arguments and take into account the full crisis that is going on with human beings throughout all of these facilities. But then when you're people who work for the Bureau of Prisons, whose job it is to protect the mass incarceration system, then you're going to say things that defy the understanding we have of science, that defy reality. And so you basically have a bunch of bureaucrats coming up with ways in which they can keep people caged. And the answer is not to do that. I mean, the fact is that that's exactly what will keep the pandemic alive. But they're in this conundrum, if you will, because they have to go against what they're actually paid to do if they're going to stop the spread of the disease.
I think one of the things that I think is telling, I think the critical difference, I think, though, is that the people running our prisons and jails at the end of the day, you know, they're police state bureaucrats, and they really don't care if the people in their custody live or die. And I'd say, you know, contrast the response of the people running prisons and jails with the response of school administrators at the elementary school, the high school, and the university level. Look at the steps that have been taken to protect students from harm versus the steps that are being taken to protect prisoners from harm. And I think that tells you kind of like everything you need to know is contrast those two responses. And again, I think, you know, the international response of how other countries are treating both their prison populations is, you know, contrast that to how the American political class is treating its prisoner population. And it's literally night and day.
It is. It's night and day. An ongoing problem. I kind of want to stay on that theme, too. There was a piece in the New York Times that, Paul, you picked up in Prison Legal News on the spread of coronavirus and how it's accelerating in U.S. jails and prisons across the country. Well, it's not just here in the United States that this is happening. It's happening around the world. And what most other countries are doing is they're just simply releasing prisoners. Now, you pointed out a few minutes ago that we are seeing that happen in some municipalities around the country. Los Angeles County Jail has been releasing nonviolent offenders just to get them out and get them away from the coronavirus, to give them a chance to not get infected. What about elsewhere in the country? Why aren't other prisons and jails releasing prisoners?
Well, I think one of the things that you've seen is the biggest increase in incarceration in this country hasn't been so much in big jurisdictions. It's been in rural areas in this country, where we've seen in a lot of rural jurisdictions with relatively low population rates, we've seen the incarceration rate increase by literally over 1,000% in terms of percentage of the population over the past 20 years or so. And our organization, the Human Rights Defense Center, we sue a lot of these small rural jails. And, you know, the pictures of squalor and misery that we see are, you know, it's just appalling. And these are the places, though, where we find that, you know, when we're the ones suing them, there's no counterbalance. The reality is the sheriffs that run these jails are often, they're the most powerful local politician. They're the biggest source of patronage, graft, and corruption in the county at that level. They have no real opposition. They have no oversight. And the people that are affected by these policies, you know, they're poor, they're unorganized, they're far from the cities where there's advocates, lawyers, and things like that that can act as kind of a check. And one of the things, last year, we sued the Baxter County Jail in Arkansas. And I've been thinking about the Baxter County Jail a lot in the last couple of weeks. When we filed a suit against this jail where it's around 100 prisoners, and contrary, I think, to a lot of expectations, they're all white, and they're in this jail. And the prisoners have no access to they're not allowed to watch television. They have no access to books. They have no access to magazines, no access to newspapers. And the jail lets them listen to the radio for 20 minutes a day. And after we filed suit, they also suspended visitation as well. And this is like a degree of isolation that, short of maybe North Korea or someplace like that, you don't really hear about prisoners being subjected to. And unfortunately, we went to trial and we lost. The federal judge of the case thought that this was a perfectly acceptable state of affairs and the prisoners don't need to have any communication. And I'm thinking this time of a corona epidemic sweeping through facilities, sweeping through prisons and jails around the country, indeed around the world, why won't you want them to have access to any type of information? And Baxter County is just one county of many around the United States where this is playing out. And in a lot of respects, I think, you know, yes, Rikers Island, we know what's happening there. It's in the center of the biggest city in the United States. It's the hub of the American media. So yes, we know what's happening in Rikers Island. People are taking notice of that. Same thing for the Cook County Jail. But what about the Baxter counties around the country? What about the small rural places where literally, you know, the person making life and death decisions about the welfare of the people caged in these places is a sheriff who, hey, he's not a public health official. He has no opposition. He has no political oversight. And he's the person ultimately making those decisions. And we're not seeing any releases of any type coming from those facilities, much less large-scale releases.
Kevin, we've got about a minute and a half left. Why don't you give us your final thoughts?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out something that my colleague, Brian Sonnenstein, who works on prisons for us at Shadowproof, has made, which is that one reason why we're seeing a lack of release of prisoners is because we've seen reformers even make up this violent versus nonviolent prisoner dichotomy. And we're really caught up over releasing nonviolent people, but keeping people who were accused of violent crimes in jails and or prisons. And this is a deadly dynamic that has been created. And there's a lot of ways you can pick this apart. I mean, quickly, my colleague has said, you know, if you abuse your partner and you're jailed for theft, are you a violent offender? I mean, historically, you have committed domestic violence, but you're actually in jail for theft. If I'm jailed for one fight, am I violent or was I provoked? You know, what is the extent to which somebody gets labeled violent? And I think that that's something that people should consider here as they're looking at what prisons and jails are dealing with, because that's played a significant role, I think, in exacerbating the crisis.
Absolutely right. And on that point, we will leave it. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He's the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area, and in Kansas City on 104.7 and 102.9 FM and 1140 AM. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.